Hello and welcome to our podcast summary of activities supporting consistent application covering the 3 months from April to June 2020. I'm Petrina Buchanan, a member of the ISB's technical staff, and I'm here today with Sue Lloyd, Vice Chair of the Board and Chair of the Interpretations Committee. We are recording this podcast remotely, so we hope it works and you can hear us clearly. And we also hope that everyone listening is well. So let's start with the two Interpretation Committee meetings that took place in April and June 2020. And at those meetings, the committee discussed five topics. And as ever, we're going to go straight to the final agenda decision published, and the topics were sale and leaseback transactions, player transfer payments, and deferred tax. So let's start with sale and leaseback transactions. And specifically what was discussed was a very specific type of sale and leaseback transaction that includes leaseback payments that are variable based on future sales from use of the leased asset. So picture an entity that owns a retail store and who sells the store and leases it back for 5 years. The buyer lessor pays the entity 1.8 million upfront for the store, which represents its fair value. And then over the 5 year lease term, the seller lessee will pay the buyer lessor a percentage of its sales from the store as consideration for the right to use the store. So ordinarily, if I was just entering into a separate lease with no preceding sale, the payments that are variable based on future sales from the store would not meet IFRS 16's definition of lease payments. So the question submitted asked about the seller lessee's accounting at the date of the sale and leaseback transaction. Firstly, how to measure the right of use asset that arises from the leaseback, and importantly, how to measure any gain or loss recognised. And it asked whether the right of use asset would be measured at zero because all the payments are variable based on future sales. So Sue, what does the agenda decision say on this?
So this is an interesting question, and we were asked a question because the leaseback payments wouldn't usually be included in the measurement of a lease liability and the right of use asset if this was just a standalone lease and not part of a sale and leaseback transaction. But because it is a sale and leaseback transaction, there's really specific requirements in IFRS 16 that apply, and those requirements mean that on disposal, the right of use asset and the liability that arises from the leaseback are measured differently from what they would be if it was just a standalone lease. And that's not by accident. That was very much the board's intention when it developed the sale and leaseback requirements. So put in non-technical language, the board wanted the gain or loss recognised on the transaction to reflect the part of the asset that was really sold to the buyer lessor, and for no gain or loss to be recognised in respect of the part of the asset that the seller effectively owned before the transaction and continues to use afterwards. And those specific requirements that apply to sale and leaseback transactions are set out in paragraphs 98 to 103 of IFRS 16. And in particular, the applicable requirements for this question are set out in paragraph 100A. So let's look at paragraph 100A. And it says, taking the example that Petrina gave us, that where the seller lessee receives 1.8 million for selling the store, and that's its fair value, and assuming that the store had a carrying amount of 1 million immediately before it was sold, if the store was just sold and there was no leaseback, the seller lessee would have recognised a gain on sale of 800,000. But in this case, because there's a 5 year leaseback, that makes a difference to the accounting. So what paragraph 100A tells us firstly is that how you have to measure the right of use asset. And it specifically says that the right of use asset recognised for the leaseback has to be measured at the proportion of the previous carrying amount of the store that relates to the right of use that was retained by the seller, who's now the lessee. So even though in the example, all of the rentals are variable based on sales, the right of use asset cannot be zero. It has to be measured as the proportion of the previous carrying amount of 1 million that relates to the 5 year right of use that's retained. And the second thing paragraph 100A says is that as a consequence, the gain recognised must represent only the amount of the gain that relates to the rights that have been transferred to the buyer lessor. So in our example, this means that the seller lessee wouldn't recognise the gain of the full $800,000, but something less than that, that represents the rights that it's transferred to the buyer lessor. Now, this topic can really only be explained fully using debits and credits, and I apologise if all those numbers are hard to follow orally, but what the agenda decision does is include a worked illustrative example which shows the debits and credits at the date of the transaction. And that illustrates that the seller lessee will recognise both a right of use asset and a liability at the date of the transaction, even in the extreme case where all the leaseback payments are variable and don't depend on an index or rate. So basically, the right of use asset and liability can't be zero when they arise in the context of a sale and leaseback transaction.
And there is actually a second step to this transaction. The agenda decision is effectively about the initial measurement, and the question that then follows is how to subsequently measure the liability that arises in the transaction. And that's actually the subject of a board project, which we'll discuss later in the podcast. So now I'm going to move on from my favourite standard IFRS 16 to what I'll describe maybe simply as not quite my favourite standard, which is IAS 38. But nonetheless, the interesting topic of player transfer fees received by a football club when it transfers a player to another football club. And if you're a regular listener to our podcasts, then you may remember that this question is really all about presentation in the income statement. On transferring a player, should the club present transfer fees received as revenue and the cost of bringing the player to the club as an operating cost, say cost of sales, or must the club present the gain or loss on transfer as a net amount in its income statement outside revenue? And the facts in this case are such that for the football club in question, it regularly brings young players to the club, develops them, and then potentially transfers them to other clubs. So the club very much would say that developing and transferring players is part of its ordinary activities. So Sue, again, can I ask you to explain what the agenda decision says?
Sure. So the agenda decision confirms that given the facts submitted, the club must present the gain or loss on transfer as a net amount and not within revenue, which means it can't present the transfer fees received as revenue. And critical to this conclusion is that the club had recognised the right it obtained on bringing the player to the club as an intangible asset applying IAS 38. And in that case, paragraph 113 of IAS 38 applies and requires the recognition of a net gain or loss on disposal of an intangible asset. And that paragraph explicitly says that gains are not classified as revenue. Now, the tentative agenda decision on this topic had gone further and it had noted that for a club whose ordinary activities include the development and transfer of players, then it was conceivable that such a club might have a portfolio of rights associated with some players that are inventories and a portfolio of rights associated with other players that are intangible assets. And of course, if you sell inventory, an entity would recognise revenue. But we've removed that section of the tentative agenda decision in finalising the final agenda decision in response to the comments that we received. Those comments basically confirmed, firstly, that football clubs generally don't recognise player rights as inventory, so it was a fairly academic point in practice that was being made. And secondly, that referring to inventory in the agenda decision was perhaps likely to raise more questions than it would give answers. So we streamline the final agenda decision and it discusses only the application of IAS 38 and mentions presentation in the cash flow statement.
Great, thank you. Now I'm going to move on to the two final agenda decisions on deferred tax. Now the first of those questions relates to whether or not, in its consolidated financial statements, an entity recognises deferred tax related to undistributed profits of a subsidiary. And this question had arisen in some Eastern European countries where profits are taxable only when distributed and the undistributed tax rate is zero. So for this question, the committee concluded that the entity recognises a deferred tax liability associated with the temporary difference that arises from the subsidiary's undistributed profits. And importantly, I will highlight that this fact pattern was such that the exemption from recognising deferred tax in paragraph 39 of IAS 12 was not met, so the entity recognises deferred tax. The second question relates to calculating deferred tax when the recovery of an asset gives rise to two distinct tax consequences. Firstly, income tax is payable on money made from using that asset. And secondly, the entity actually will receive a capital gains tax deduction equal to the cost of the asset at the end of the asset's life. And again, important in this fact pattern is that the tax law applicable prohibits using the capital gains tax deduction to offset the income tax payable. And here the committee concluded that the entity identifies two temporary differences that reflect the two distinct tax consequences from recovery of the asset. Firstly, there's the income tax consequence. And then secondly, there's the capital gains tax consequence, which cannot be offset. So the entity then recognises and measures deferred tax on those two temporary differences separately. So that's the four final agenda decisions published in the last 3 months. Let's move on now to the final topic that the committee discussed, which is reverse factoring. So I'm going to ask you to walk us through this one.
Okay, thanks. And it's probably good to start just by making sure everybody knows what reverse factoring actually is. And this is basically an increasingly popular way of arranging for suppliers to get paid earlier than their customer, who's the reporting entity for IFRS purposes, has to pay. And it's typically done by involving a third-party financial institution. So the financial institution agrees to pay amounts owed by the reporting entity to its suppliers, and the entity then agrees to pay the financial institution at a date later than when the suppliers were paid. And as some of you listening might know, there have been some concerns that these arrangements aren't always very visible, and they could be seen as a way of hiding indebtedness. And in fact, the question came to us from investors who had concerns along those lines. However, it's important to note that there are real business reasons for why companies might choose to enter into these arrangements, not least because it can allow suppliers to get paid earlier and at a cheaper price than they could get if they were arranging to get cash early in any other way. And this is because the pricing is often based on the credit rating of the customer. So many large, well-established entities with good credit ratings have set up these arrangements to facilitate their suppliers getting paid earlier at a good price, whilst the entity continues to pay amounts owed for goods and services based on the usual credit terms, but to the financial institution. But these arrangements can also be used to extend an entity's credit terms, which increases risks for the entity, especially if it gets into financial difficulty. And investors and rating agencies have been vocal in wanting some more information about these arrangements because of these very particular risks that can arise. So now on to the questions that the committee received. And the committee was asked to look at two questions about these arrangements. Firstly, how should an entity present liabilities that are part of a reverse factoring arrangement on the face of the financial statements? And secondly, what information should it consider disclosing in the notes to the financial statements about these arrangements? So the committee first discussed presentation on the balance sheet and noted that IAS 1 requires an entity to present financial liabilities that are trade and other payables separately from other financial liabilities on its balance sheet. And the committee identified the characteristics of trade payables and when other payables should be presented together with trade payables. The committee also noted that IAS 1 goes on to require separate presentation of liabilities when their size, nature or function makes that presentation relevant to understand the entity's financial position. And again, the committee looked at some of the characteristics of reverse factoring that might mean that separate presentation on the face of the balance sheet is required by IAS 1. The committee also discussed the statement of cash flows and how an entity needs to decide whether to present the related cash flows as arising from operating activities or financing activities in accordance with IAS 7 when they're doing reverse factoring, And the tentative agenda decision explains some of the factors the committee thought should be considered in doing this, and also some of the disclosures that are required by IAS 7. And finally, the tentative agenda decision explains various disclosure requirements that are applicable to reverse factoring arrangements. And in particular, it highlights the disclosures required by IFRS 7 in relation to liquidity risk. And what I find really helpful in the tentative agenda decision is that it not only describes and highlights the disclosure requirements that are relevant, but it really tries to explain what it is about entering into a reverse factoring arrangement that creates special aspects of liquidity risk, and thus why the IFRS 7 disclosure requirements could be particularly important if these arrangements are material for a reporting entity. So that's a little bit of an advertisement. I'm hoping you'll look at the tentative agenda decision. It's an important one, and we'd be really interested to hear your views on it. Based on the feedback that we got in our outreach and the committee's discussion, we did think that maybe the information that's available at the moment in financial statements about reverse factoring arrangements isn't as good as it perhaps could be or should be. So in responding, we'd also be particularly interested if you could let us know what you think is missing in the existing requirements in IAS 1, IAS 7 and IFRS 7 that might facilitate entities providing useful information about these arrangements. We felt that there was quite a lot of relevant requirements there already, but they don't seem to be resulting in the sort of information that we thought perhaps should be prompted to be provided.
Great. Thank you, Sue. Now, it's worth noting that committee members also provided their views and some preliminary staff thinking about possible specific disclosure requirements that the board might add on reverse factoring and similar arrangements. Now, any such specific disclosure requirements would require standard setting, so it's something we'll consider further together with the feedback that we get on the tentative agenda decision. Now, a reminder that the committee's conclusions on reverse factoring arrangements are, of course, tentative and they're now out for comment. And we certainly encourage you to send us your comments. In this case, given all that's going on at the moment, to ensure you have enough time to do that, the comment period is actually open for more than 90 days until the 30th of September. So now moving on, we've covered the committee meetings. What I now wanted to do is just highlight some progress that the board has made in the past 3 months on some narrow scope projects to support consistent application, and also in how the board responded to some COVID-19 challenges. And so maybe we'll start with COVID-19 related rent concessions, and I'll ask you to cover that.
Sure. So in early April, through discussions with our stakeholders, we heard that as a result of the current pandemic, many rent concessions were being agreed to by lessors, either voluntarily or because governments have asked lessors to provide concessions. So lessees are quite commonly being given a break from paying rent or being allowed to pay reduced rent for a period of time, often with increased payments being required in subsequent periods. And if you're listening to this podcast, you may already be aware of what the board has done with rent concessions, but I'll just do a brief summary for completeness. So in IFRS 16, as it was written, entities were required to assess whether the change in rent payments was considered to be a lease modification or not. And to do that, you really needed to look at the contract and any applicable law or regulation to work out whether you thought the concession was part of something contemplated by the original terms and conditions, and also seeing if the consideration for the lease had been changed as a result of the concessions. So the first thing we did in early April was to publish some educational materials to explain the existing requirements to help both lessees and lessors work out whether a rent concession is a lease modification or not. But in addition to that, we made an amendment in May to IFRS 16 to provide some practical relief to lessees while still ensuring that they would be providing useful information to their investors. And in a nutshell, that amendment means that lessees can choose not to assess whether particular rent concessions are lease modifications and basically be allowed to choose to assume that they aren't lease modifications and to apply simpler accounting as a result. Disclosure is required as a result of that. It's not too onerous, but you do need to point out the effect of choosing this option, and you need to apply the relief to all leases with similar characteristics.
Great. And finally, I'm just going to mention two narrow scope board projects that actually started from submissions to the committee. Now, if you have a better memory than I do, then you might remember that in 2019, we told you about a possible narrow scope project that would aim to fill a gap in IAS 21 by proposing requirements that would apply when exchangeability of a currency is lacking. So this, for example, was the situation in Venezuela, and it's possibly also the situation in a few other countries. And such a project would fill a gap because IAS 21 is written to assume that all currencies are exchangeable. So it really doesn't tell a company what to do if a currency is not exchangeable. And so the board has now added that project to its work plan, and it will propose to add requirements to IAS 21 that'll specify, first of all, when exchangeability of a currency is lacking. Secondly, it'll propose to say that an entity would estimate the exchange rate when exchangeability is lacking. And finally, it'll set out some disclosure requirements that would need to be complied with and made when exchangeability is lacking. So you can expect an exposure draft on lack of exchangeability close to the end of 2020. Also in April, the board added a new narrow scope project on sale and leaseback transactions with variable payments, as we mentioned earlier. Now, you might ask why such a project is needed if the committee addressed the topic in an agenda decision, which is a good question. And actually, the reason here is that the agenda decision basically addresses the initial measurement around such a transaction, for which there are requirements in paragraph 100A of IFRS 16. However, IFRS 16 does not specify how the seller lessee subsequently measures the liability that arises in such a sale and leaseback transaction. So this narrow scope board project will again fill a gap, this time in IFRS 16, to address how to subsequently measure the liability that arises in a sale and leaseback transaction. And it's important to note that the project affects only sale and leaseback transactions, and in particular those with variable leaseback payments. Importantly, this narrow scope project will not propose any changes to the requirements for separate standalone leases. So in this one, you can expect an exposure draft in September. So with that, that brings our podcast to a close. It's been a busy few months on the consistent application front.
And actually, before we sign off, Petrina, I'm conscious we've been talking for a while, but it's probably a good point to just quickly acknowledge that the June meeting was a bit of a sad one for the committee, because four of our members' terms have ended. So Bonnie, Mikhail, Carl and Bruce. And also it was the last committee meeting for two of our board observers, Gary and Chung Wu. So as chair, I'd like to use the podcast to say thank you to them all for making really helpful contributions to the committee, and to say that we're going to miss them.
Oh, absolutely. I second that. So change coming up at the committee soon. Okay, thank you, Sue, and thank you to everybody for listening. We hope you found the podcast useful. Please email communications@ifrs.org if you have any suggestions for improvement. Take care, thank you, and goodbye.